The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So this is really a terrific time, I think, to be having this panel, because the Me Too movement, just like the Slut Walk movement before it, has sparked an international conversation around sexual violence. I was actually recently in India in May, and I got to meet with friends and family, and I was really struck by how many people want to talk about sexual violence. And by the way, this is a new development. You know, if you've seen, this is because it never used to be this openly talked about, right? If you've seen the movie Monsoon Wedding, if you haven't seen it, you know, it's something to be hidden, repressed, denied even, but not certainly something to be thought about, analyzed, and fought back against. Of course, this is not new. Ever since 2012, when a young woman by the name of Jyoti Singh was gang raped, and then she died of, you know, the horrible torture that was inflicted on her, you saw a massive rise of protests around rape and sexual violence in India. Most recently, what brought this issue back again into the news was the rape and murder of an 8-year-old Muslim girl in Kashmir. An 8-year-old girl, you know, wrap your head around that. So it's the Me Too campaign combined with the case of Asifa Bano, this young Kashmiri Muslim girl, that prompted India Today, the main magazine, if you will, somewhat like the Time magazine equivalent in India, to run a cover story on sexual violence against children, particularly young girls. And of course, you know, the article doesn't go into the political nature of this rape against Asifa Bano, doesn't talk about the fact that the rapists were primarily Hindu government officials and police officers who were trying to send a message through this young Muslim girl to her community to get out of that area in Kashmir, right? It doesn't talk about the context of the Indian occupation of Kashmir or about the Modi government and Prime Minister Modi himself, who just, you know, kept quiet about this issue because after all, it was a Muslim girl. So none of that was mentioned, but nevertheless, despite the lack of discussion of occupation, racism, right-wing nationalism, and misogyny, it was nevertheless significant that the premier magazine in India saw fit to highlight the scope and scale of violence against girls. Now, I was actually reading this article on my way back to the United States on the plane, and on the European leg, I was on British Airways, and I was reading, and you know, it was punctuated by this announcement, which you see a video, and then you have an announcement about how all of us should, you know, empty our pockets of whatever change and currency we have and give it to British Airways, because British Airways is on the front line of fighting the war on poverty on children, how it's trying to improve the lives of children around the world. I mean, barf, right? But now, I raise this not because I'm in the habit of talking about my travels and, you know, boring people with it, but really because this is the ruse of neoliberalism, right? This is the trick that sustains an unpalatable system like neoliberalism. So if you look at the level of devastation and poverty created during this era of neoliberal capitalism over the last 40 years or so, which is responsible for the kind of problems that British Airways is claiming to actually solve, the solution that is presented is so shallow and so self-serving, right? Because at the end of the day, it makes British Airways look good, and it presents the market as the solution to precisely the problems created by the market. And so what I want to do in my talk to in the few minutes that I have today is talk about how not to fight the global war on women, and to make a case for why we should reject the dominant logic of neoliberal imperial feminism, right? So first, what is imperial feminism? It is a false feminism. It is the use of women's rights and women's liberation to advance empire. It has its origins in the European colonization of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, and it was a means of justifying colonialism. And today's imperial feminism has a lot in common with its predecessor, But it also, there is something new about neoliberal imperial feminism, and that's what I want to spend the bulk of my time on. So first of all, what does it have in common with its predecessor? I think after the Afghan war, when a not so feminist president like George Bush could claim that the NATO-US occupation was about liberating Afghan women, I think it became clear to most of us on the left that this was a sham, right? This was an ideological cover for the US-NATO war in that country. But what I want to argue is that it's important for us to not limit our understanding of imperial feminism simply to the use of war to supposedly liberate women in the global south, but to actually expand that to look at how neoliberalism itself reproduces itself both ideologically and materially through a set of practices as well as an ideology, which I'm calling neoliberal imperial feminism. So there are a couple of characteristics about neoliberal imperial feminism, which I think are important to flesh out. First and foremost, it's about the market, right? The market has become the key means to supposedly liberate women. Let me give you an example to concretize this. Again, Afghanistan. You may have heard of a campaign called Beauty Without Borders, sponsored by Revlon, L'Oreal, and other cosmetic companies, whose goal was to liberate women by teaching them how to be beauticians and to open beauty salons. Now, I'm not even going to go into the idiocy and the sexism behind a campaign of this sort, but I want to point here that becoming entrepreneurs, right, is presented as the way that women can liberate themselves, not collectively organizing with their sisters against occupation and the misogynistic warlords and for self-determination, but teaching themselves a set of skills and setting up a shop. Well, what about, and this kind of empowerment, right, is it's not just in Afghanistan. These kind of campaigns are global. Well, what about us in the West? What are we supposed to do? First of all, we are not oppressed, right? People who live in the West have, never mind the Me Too moment and so on. Most of these campaigns don't talk about, sexual violence in the West and so forth. But it's now become the new white woman's burden, or if you will, the Western woman's burden, to give money and to go shopping to liberate their sisters. Here's how Leela Abu Lagood puts it in her book, Do Muslim Women Need Saving? She says, quote, "The 1 in 3 women global campaign to raise awareness around violence against women asks you to buy their cards, charms, and dog tags. Peacekeeper Cosmetic asks you to support women's causes by purchasing their lipsticks and their nail polish. They only, of course, only give a fraction to fight violence against women in Muslim-majority countries. Hirsi Ali's foundation is only the most recent to pick up this commercialization of women's rights, inviting us to get our own high-quality honor tote bag for a donation." End quote. So the way to build solidarity with women around the world has become marketized and directed towards shopping and charity if you live in the West, and the rescue through entrepreneurialism if you live in the global South. And this brings me then to the second aspect of the neoliberal form of imperial feminism, which is the way in which governments have appropriated feminism into a system where the crisis of care, right, care for the elderly, care for the sick, care for children, and so on, which, by the way, has been produced by neoliberalism's attack on welfare and social services, are actually met primarily by immigrant non-Western women, right? There have been a ton of women from North Africa, the Middle East, and so on, moving into various European countries. And what Sarah Farris argues in her book, In the Name of Women's Rights, The Rise of Femonationalism, is that these migrant women, particularly non-Western migrant women, have been channeled into care work and domestic work as a way of liberating them. So as Western Europe has privatized welfare services in the neoliberal era and is facing a growing elderly population with no one to care for them, migrant women have been pushed into tasks like housekeeping, childcare, and caregiving for the sick and the elderly. And what's insidious about this is that it gets done through what are called civic integration programs, where migrant women are taught that one of the great pillars of Western nations is women's liberation, women's ability to work outside the home, and so on. But what kind of jobs are these women given? Low-paying, precarious jobs that ultimately really serve to meet the social reproduction needs of Western nations rather than liberate these women in any way. Now, the last aspect of neoliberal imperial feminism that I'll talk about is NGOs and the role played by NGOs. Now, we have seen the massive growth of NGOs from the 1980s to the present, who pretty much stepped in to offer critical social services axed in the neoliberal era. Today, it would not be an exaggeration to say that NGOs have become crucial players, both on the national as well as the global stage. Sabine Lang has coined a term for this. She calls it the NGOization of feminism. And by this, she means two things. Not only one, the massive growth of feminist NGOs through the 1990s and the 2000s, which have now become the face, if you will, of feminism, but two, the process whereby NGOs have actually co-opted grassroots feminist movements and the best activists from these movements. So before I go, give you some examples of this, I mean, I don't mean to have a blanket condemnation of all NGOs. Certainly it's true that in places where desperately needed services, you know, are not being provided by the government, NGOs are doing some good work and so on, and certainly NGOs aren't a monolith. But it's important, I think, also to note that the best funded NGOs, and therefore the most powerful NGOs, are tied to all sorts of corporations for their funding, as well as to governments for their fundings, and as such, carry out a program that benefits the people who actually sponsor them, right? This is why it's become a sort of liberal, rights-based approach and a politics of capitalist entrepreneurialism and developmentalism, which, you know, does nothing to talk about the structural context of capitalism and imperialism. So let me give an example. In Gaza and the West Bank, we've seen a massive increase in the number of NGOs since the 1990s. What has been the result? The result has been to demobilize the Palestinian women's movement, which used to be political, activist, and grassroots. Additionally, various human rights activists and researchers, you know, well-intentioned people who have gone to the area and have done some incredible work documenting the impact on women of Israeli occupation and its siege of Gaza, complain that miraculously, when the final report appears, the context of occupation is just gone, right? So groups like Human Rights Watch and so on will take the most superficial parts of what people are doing and completely erase the context of Israeli occupation. And this is what makes it possible to provide these sort of individualistic solutions to what are really structural problems. So I'm going to come to a close by quickly summarizing and, you know, offering what I think we should do. So what I've done is laid out four ways in which neoliberal imperial feminism manifests itself in the 21st century. This is by no means an exhaustive list. It's what I could cram into 12 to 13 minutes get away with. But the argument that I really tried to lay out in brief is that neoliberal imperial feminism is not simply an ideology used to justify war and occupation, but it is a set of practices that help to sustain neoliberalism, to reproduce neoliberalism, and to demobilize feminist social movements. And I'll come to a close with this. In opposition to this, we need to have this kind of work, right? That is to say, build transnational grassroots movements from below that talks about the global problems that women face, even if these problems look different in different places, and how we can come together as collectives, not individuals, outside the market to actually fight back against the depredations of neoliberalism, but also at the same time think about what it means to live in a completely different society, a socialist society, where we don't have to keep fighting these struggles again and again. So I'll end there. Thank you very much.
I'm just standing here awkwardly. Next, we have Gloria Trogo.
I think it's on. Oh. Somebody. Forget you.
Well, good afternoon for everyone. I'm gonna read because my English is not so good to speak free here. So I'm gonna read what I prepared. Just I'd like to add in this beginning that all of DIPA says now, it's very, very useful to Brazil today and very, very useful for our women's movement. In this explanation, it's brilliant, congratulations. I would like to make a small video with this and passing Brazil for our camera because it's very useful. Bom, in the subject of this session, there is the expression war on women. So when I was preparing, I would like to start talking about an execution that became a symbol of our struggle. It's in my T-shirt. She's Marielle Franco. She's a councillor of Rio de Janeiro. She's from our party. She is a black woman, bisexual, socialist, brutally executed. Marielle was from Mara Complex, is a slum, a favela, a big slum in Rio de Janeiro. And her death is an expression of our struggle in many ways. I will talk about this in this explanation. She became a councillor 2 years ago, just 2 years ago, in an electoral phenomenon that reflected the struggles of oppressed people. Like her, PSOL elected the most voted candidate in any other important cities, all black women. The feminist movement in Brazil does not have an organic and national organization. They are composed of local and regional movements. A national map of women's collectives indicated that there are more than 200 groups in the country. Women and oppressed sectors are in the front foot of the resistance in Brazil and I think in the world too. Within the ruling class global offensive against the working class, we are seeing the emergency of democratic mass struggles that gain support from thousands of people. The historical crisis that has been going through capitalism since 2008 highlights deep contradictions that the ruling class can no longer resolve without imposing unprecedented degrees of exploitation. The growth of extreme right movements, the option for racist agendas against immigrants, against women's reproductive rights, increase the LGBT phobia and all the machismo, the racism. I don't know if you say machismo, if it's okay, machismo. Sexism or misogyny, politics increase a lot. This kind of politicians and this kind of politics in our country, and I think in the rest of the world too. The articulators and protagonists of the parliamentary coup in Brazil are those parties of traditional right with a historical position against the women's. There is a neoliberal right in the economy and conservative in the customs. For them, the state should not interfere in the economy. So they advocate, for example, for privatizations of the state. But the body of women, yes, the state has to intervene. So the oil national company in Brazil, Petrobras, should be privatized because the state does not have anything with this oil company. But our bodies, yes, the state have to regulate everything. There are more than 6 projects actually in Brazil that attack women's reproductive rights in the opposite way of Argentina. The abortion is not legalized in Brazil. It's a crime, but it's not it's not enough for them. So they want now to become crime the abortion in case of rape too. So they want more, you know, this is the movement of the extreme right in Brazil today. But there are fight and resistance in our side. So second point, our struggles in the last few years. In two moments, the women's struggle, it was very, very important. One of those, it was we call it there, it's so-called Sprint Feminist, a wave of mobilizations against Eduardo Cunha. Eduardo Cunha is a traditional right politician in Brazil. And the detonator of these demonstrations was a collective rape that took place in Rio de Janeiro. One young girl raped by five men, and everybody go to the streets and protest against him because he is the author of the project that want to criminalize the abort in case of rape. He is this man. He's the same one that put in the Congress the theme of the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. He was the president of the Congress, and it's the same one that is the author of this project. So just to understand who are the persons in this background. And one second moment, the 8M, the 8th March in 2017, the demonstrations were really big, really big, and they prepared a very, very important moment of struggle and resistance of the workers in Brazil, that it was the general strike of 28 April. But in this year, last year, the 8M, it was an expression that there were anything moving in the class, you know? The 8M was big, and everyone look and think. And you think it's different here. Let's see. And this develop in the general strike in the end of April. There is a new reality within social movements, a profound and recent change. All women's activists define themselves as feminists. And there is an awakening of this consciousness in thousands of women, including women that are not activists, as not socialist activists, as not from her unions, are just women. They are waiting for this time. Bom, third thing, programmatic changes of the left, in our country at least. To conclude, I would like to say about program and how to fight against oppression in our view. The Marxism has a view about the relation between oppression and exploitation. We know that both are related with the capitalism system and are not an individual problem. But the oppressions expressed in many ways inside the working class is different from the exploitation that in all his expression is between two opposite classes. And with the oppression is not like this, you know? There are an expression of the oppressions inside the working class. So it's opened the way to influence of other strategies inside the feminist movement. And there are a bourgeois politic for the oppressed people. Deepa talk about this here. A hard politic to convince the oppressed people that the problem is individual. And are a lot of tactics with this background comprehension about the problem of the oppression. If you think that it's individual, you fight against other individual. Yeah. It's not a class fight, it's a class between individuals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a class that in the end divides the class, the working class. And the state and the bourgeois that nothing with this. This is the ideology, it's very powerful in the movement there. Today in Brazil, the Marxism view is minoritary in the feminist movement. And unfortunately, the identity politics and postmodern politics influences are more strong inside the left than the socialist left influence these movements. You know, they influence all the left, and the left, it's not strong to influence the feminist movement in this point. In our view, there is a crisis of strategy, a big crisis of strategy, because if you are fighting against and the person who is your side, you can't win. Okay. If you don't know the enemy, you can't win the struggle, you know. And this is very strong. It's time to study, in our opinion, to learn to give a correct answer, and to stay together and fight against sexism, chauvinism, society in general, but especially fight against sexism and machism inside the working class. We have to fight. Because if we don't fight, we leave to bourgeoisie the way it's open. Okay. So this is the first thing we think it's very, very important now. Give practical examples of fighting against oppression, to open the way, to say our program, to say our Marxist view. You have to begin with practical examples. And a battle for a Marxism view that articulated the oppressed with the exploitation, and that show in all the small things how the problem is the capital and not another individual. That's it. Thank you.
Hey, so I think what Gloria just said about the mass feminist awakening is really true globally, and I'm excited that I get to talk about that manifestation in Argentina, where there's actually been some organizational weight and some victory. But first, you know, Lichi said that I live in New York, and I vicariously live through Argentina. There's a very strong left. But you know, and I got to visit recently. But I also think the beauty of being an internationalist is that when there's a victory in Argentina, there's a victory in the United States, and when there's a victory in Argentina, there's a victory in Brazil. You know, legally speaking, in the United States, there's much more far-reaching access to abortion than in any country in Latin America. In Latin America, 97% of women live places where there are prohibitively restrictive abortion laws. But something is, in Argentina, something has changed, and it's changed quite rapidly, qualitatively. Probably people have followed it. On June 14th, the lower house of Congress passed a bill legalizing abortion in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy in a 129-125 vote, which is a very close vote, after they had deliberated for 22 hours. The existing regulation in Argentina only allows abortion in extreme circumstances. But even in those circumstances, it's left up pretty much to the discretion of the individual doctor and to a bureaucratic system, which makes it almost impossible to actually access. The second round, the Senate's going to vote on whether to approve this bill on August 8th, so keep your eyes on that. But I think we should say definitively that whatever happens in that Senate hearing, something has changed that's not going to be unchanged in Argentina, and that these legislative sessions themselves are hard-won advances for the women's rights movement that's begun to assert itself in Argentina. This isn't the first time that women have organized for an abortion bill in Argentina. There's actually been 7 bills introduced in the last 13 years, but something is different today. There's been a growing movement around women's rights that's become significantly more radical in the most recent period. Since 1986, there's been an annual feminist event in Argentina, the National Women's Gathering, and it's grown every year since its inception. In recent years, it's actually drawn 60 to 80,000 people. In 2001, the Piquetero movement, which flowered in the response to the economic collapse that produced mass protests across Argentina, it also brought with it a flowering of feminist organizing. And out of the conference that year, in 2001, a national campaign for abortion rights was launched. 2 years later, this culminated in a coalition of 300 organizations that centered around 3 demands. Sexual education to decide, contraception to avoid abortion, sorry, to avoid pregnancy, and legal abortion not to die. Years ago, activists launched this propaganda campaign, highlighting the fact that abortions will occur whether or not they are legal, and they reshaped the stakes to be about women's lives and women's health. In Argentina, statistics say that 40% of abortions, 40% of pregnancies are terminated, which is about 500,000 pregnancies a year. And the fact that these abortions are happening extra legally makes them the top cause of maternal mortality in the country. And that's the case in every country where abortion is restricted. This campaign aimed to reframe the question to be about public health, to be about a public health crisis, and not about this highly entrenched Catholic notion about where life begins. And by the way, the Pope is Argentinian right now. And they have very, very long argued that abortion is worse than pedophilia, and they've gone as far as to say that abortion is worse than dictatorship, which the Argentinian people know about very well. In the last couple of years, abortion has been posed even more radically as a fundamental question of a woman being able to control her own body and her own life. Along with the statistics that I talked about, along with the growth of the existing feminist organizations, there's been another important dynamic that's played out and that has incredibly impacted this discussion. Along with all the unnecessary deaths that happen because women don't have access to safe, legal, free abortion, there's another statistic that needs to be introduced here, which is that in Argentina, every 36 hours, a woman is killed by her husband or her partner. And this has produced an incredible movement against femicide. The slogan that they've adopted is ni una menos, not one less. And at the announcement of new murders, there's mass protests that happen, spontaneous protests. And it's very much given credence to the idea that women are full human beings who don't belong to her partner, who has a right to her life, who has a right to her health. And I think that the demand for abortion and the demand against femicide is fully encapsulated in the ni una menos slogan. The ni una menos phenomenon has rapidly changed the terrain and the confidence around women's rights. And in doing so, it has even begun to raise some of the systemic questions about the economic and social system that has forced women to be second-class citizens for so long. And there's very much a wing of the movement that is drawing anti-capitalist conclusions. So I just want to wrap up with a couple of lessons, I guess, and then we can move on and have more time for discussion. But the first thing is that this shows that it doesn't matter whether the people in government agree with you. They can be impacted by what happens outside of the Congress if there are mass mobilizations, and there were mass mobilizations, and I encourage everyone to look them up and see them because it's incredible. What's more, not one of the major parties in Argentina supported abortion, but still it was on the table. And this is a lesson that Argentines know very well. Demonstrations in Argentina broke a dictatorship and restored democratic rule almost 40 years ago, and that's a lesson that you can't just take from people. The second lesson, although this movement has been going on for decades, I think it's actually interesting that the watershed moment where this has actually made big headway did not come during the Pink Tide, when there were progressive candidates that swept Latin America in opposition to the neoliberal order. It's under Macri, who is a right-wing, pro-corporate, anti-social welfare president, and you can't help but compare him to Trump in a lot of ways. It's under Macri, it's with an Argentine pope, that every party in Argentina is being forced to decide, do you side with the Vatican, or do you side with women who are organizing for their right not to die because of lack of access to abortion and lack of you know, being seen as a full human being. There are openings today that didn't exist yesterday. Both the left and the right wing have openings. If the left is organized and mobilized, we can take advantage, and I think this is such an important example of that. Every party in Argentina, including that of Macri and that of Kirchner, who is a Peronist who was very much, you know, came out of the Pink Tide, both of the parties have been split on the question of abortion since the mass mobilizations. I don't want to give a prediction, but I don't think it's completely out of the question that this could pass the Senate in August. The third thing I wanted to say, and then I'll finish, is just that sexism adds to the horrors of a period of social crisis in exponential ways. And in many countries, the response to the outcomes of this sexism is actually the leading edge of resistance. And I think this is true in the United States with Me Too, and I think it's true in Argentina with the Ni Una Menos and the abortion campaigns. Socialists should never see these struggles as being counterposed to building a class movement. They're actually a central part of that process, and they are organizing towards an alternative to capitalism. And there's a moment right now where they're actually leading the way in showing how things that once seemed impossible are actually could be put on the table if our forces are strong enough.
Gracias por la invitación a las compañeras y compañeros de ISO. Varias de las análisis que hacen las compañeras que me antecedieron las comparto. No voy a repetirlas, son las que se refieren a la mediatización a través de las ONGs del movimiento, a la pérdida de radicalidad del movimiento feminista en México y en América Latina, con sus excepciones.
Hello, comrades. Thanks to the ISO for inviting me. I just want to say that I share the several analyses put forward by the comrades and that I won't repeat them, but that, you know, it's similar to what we've seen with the mediatization of the feminist movement and the reliance on NGOs, in which we then see a loss of radicalism in Mexico and Latin America.
Un fenómeno complejo que ha sido muy analizado en el feminismo en América Latina, porque a todos nos ha tocado, y que en el caso de México se abrió este periodo, principios de los 90s, y particularmente con la reconfiguración de la izquierda en México, cuando se fundó el Partido de la Revolución Democrática, PRD, donde la mayor parte de la izquierda revolucionaria se unió a esa opción reformista.
And so this is obviously a complex phenomenon. What we've seen in the Mexican case, for example, is that in the 1990s we had an opening. We had an opening period in which the left reconfigured itself around this reformist party, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD, and most of the left united within this reformist movement.
Lo que implicó que, como se había la posibilidad de hacer cambios en la legislación, muchas de las feministas fueron a trabajar para impulsar esos cambios políticos que se necesitaban, dado que nuestro marco jurídico era absolutamente, no tenía incorporado, ¿no?, los derechos humanos.
And so, of course, what happened is that, you know, many feminists began to incorporate themselves in this reformist process, and they began to change laws because the political framework that we had in Mexico didn't have any laws, right, for women or human rights.
So, ahora tenemos muchas leyes muy buenas y un movimiento que en ese camino perdió, digamos, esa presencia que tuvo en algún momento, nunca fue masiva, pero sobre todo es el fenómeno, ¿no?, de la deslavamiento, pues, del discurso
y la práctica y los debates de las estrategias.
Permíteme.
Okay. Ahorramos tiempo, ¿no?
So, you know, what came out of this was a lot of good laws, right, that the movement put, that the feminist movement put forward, but at the same time the movement began to lose a presence. I mean, it was never a mass movement, but it began to be dislodged in a sense, right? It lost its political practice through reformism.
Así que, bueno, eso es el contexto, pero con relación, me gustó mucho el tema de la plática de la guerra de las mujeres. Yo durante muchos años estuve hablando de la guerra de las mujeres y después, como la guerra se volvió en serio en México, ¿no?, con el periodo que se abrió de la guerra contra el narcotráfico en el 2007, y entonces la guerra era en serio, entonces ya dejé de hablar de eso porque ya me parecía que estaba todo muy terrible. Pero eso nos generó una complicación terrible porque se incrementó el feminicidio que nosotros tenemos desde 1993, se incrementó la criminalización de las mujeres por abortar, criminalización a defensoras de derechos humanos, fenómeno de trata.
And so within this context, right, I really, really like the topic of the war on women for many years. This is the work that I had been doing and talking about from our Mexican perspective about the war on women. But when we had the launch of the drug war in Mexico, which unleashed terrible consequences, I decided to stop talking about the war on women, right? Because we've had a battle against femicides since 1993.
sí, bueno, en todo caso, lo que quiero decir es de que realmente se nos puso muy difícil en México. Y entonces, ¿qué pasó con las mujeres? ¿No? Es decir, que es interesante que veamos qué pasa cuando ocurre un contexto de este tipo de violencia, ¿no? Porque entonces lo que empezaron a aparecer son mujeres que se empezaron a organizar, pero a buscar a sus hijas desaparecidas.
So it's very interesting, right, that we see kind of what happens within this context of extreme violence that's very difficult. And what we begin to see is an increase in women organizing, but what they're organizing for is to look for their disappeared, is women's organizations that look for their disappeared family members, mostly women.
Y otra cosa todavía más terrible es las mujeres que se han organizado para ir escarbar en la tierra a buscar los cadáveres.
Las rastreadoras, ¿no?
And then, the other most terrible thing that has also been a result, but has emerged as a form of organization, is the women who organize themselves to go look for mass graves, women that have become known as the searchers, rastreadoras, that are trying to follow some leads to look for disappeared bodies.
A este tipo de violencia estructural capitalista voy a mencionar en particular contra el cuerpo de las mujeres inició una ofensiva de la derecha en el año de 2007 a partir de que se aprobó la legalización del aborto en la Ciudad de México.
And from what we see, right, in response to this type of the violence of capitalism on the women's on the bodies of women in Mexico, we see a resurgence of the right wing after 2007, when abortion became legalized in Mexico City.
Y el avance de la derecha logró la legislación en 17 estados de 32 de legislar el derecho a la vida desde la concepción.
And so the right wing won a state-by-state fight in which they criminalized abortion in 17 out of the 32 states by arguing and winning that life begins at the point of conception.
Por eso para las mexicanas, cuando en el 2015 vimos cómo se movilizaban las argentinas y surge el movimiento de Ni Una Más, para nosotros es el movimiento en México, el eslogan era Ni Una Menos, que es la frase que acuñó Susana Chávez, que la nombro en esos momentos, que fue asesinada en 2010. Cuando surge el Ni Una Más, pues fue un viento de alegría para nosotras.
And so for Mexican women, we take a lot of inspiration in the movement that emerges in Argentina in 2017, the Ni Una Menos movement, the Not One More, because in Mexico we had previously had the Ni Una Menos, Ni Una Más movement in Argentina. In Mexico we have the Ni Una Menos, Not One Less women, right? And I want to bring this up because this is something that was pushed by Susana Chavez in 2007, in 2010, right? And she was a woman that was murdered for her activism.
Y pensamos que para nosotras en América Latina ese es el momento en que marca una diferencia. A lo mejor mucha gente no se dio cuenta, ¿no? Como ahora. Pero ese es un año clave. Para nosotras el 2006 fue todavía mucho más interesante porque en la primera movilización que tenemos, el primer despunte de mujeres jóvenes, la nueva generación que se colocó protestando contra las violencias machistas y el acoso sexual, fue el 24 de abril de 2016.
So again, for us in Latin America, right? This this makes a huge difference. These years of 2010, 2015 make a huge difference, because unlike now, for example, people might not have heard about it so much like they've heard about it in these years. In Mexico, 2006 is also a key year for women, right? We begin to see the rise of marches in which more young women begin to come into the movement to protest machismo and sexual harassment.
Por lo que el impacto de las movilizaciones en Polonia en 2016, el 19 de octubre, la movilización latinoamericana Apoyo a Lucía Pérez, ¿no? que se realizó, tuvieron impacto y lograron otra vez movilizar a mujeres a nivel nacional por primera vez en la historia del movimiento feminista mexicano.
So again, the protests in 2016 were also very remarkable, especially in Poland in the 19th of October marches. In Latin America, we had marches for Lucía Pérez, and this had a very big impact because for the first time in Mexican history, it draws in wider sectors of women.
Puedo hablar mucho sobre esto. Lo único que voy a destacar es de que lo que me parece muy importante es de que yo diría que para las jóvenes estudiantes de las universidades en México, el 24 de abril es su Me Too, ¿no? Sería el Me Too mexicano en escala modesta, no tiene nada que ver, pero ahí se abre esa lucha, que es una lucha muy difícil, totalmente aisladas, no tienen apoyo del movimiento, porque es un movimiento desarticulado, las instituciones no están respondiendo, es una lucha que se encuentra, yo diría, en una especie de pantano, ¿no? Por las resistencias académicas también.
So, I mean, I could talk more about this. I just want to highlight one case in particular for young women in Mexico. The 24th of April for us was like our Me Too moment. On a smaller scale, of course, in Mexico, but it was a very difficult struggle for women in the universities because they were not receiving a lot of support from the movement, and also they were receiving resistance from the university administration.
No me quiero extender mucho porque creo que es importante abrir la discusión. Solo quiero mencionar que el impacto del llamado a la huelga internacional de las mujeres fue muy importante en México en 2016, si bien no tuvo movilizaciones masivas, ¿no? Es decir, como cogieron Argentina, Uruguay, etcétera, pero para nuestra situación sí marcó una diferencia, además porque tuvo un impacto y abrió, como dicen ustedes, conversaciones o discusiones en la izquierda sobre la huelga como una herramienta, ¿no? de lucha, de organización contra el patriarcado capitalista.
So I won't extend myself because I want to open up the discussion, but I will mention the impact of the International Women's Strike on Mexico, which again, even though in 2016 we didn't have mass demonstrations in Mexico like we did have in Argentina or Uruguay, for us it made a huge difference in Mexico, right, to see the impact of how women are reclaiming the strike as a weapon against machista capitalist violence.
En el 2007, la huelga internacional de las mujeres en México se vivió de muy distinta manera, por dos razones. Una, por el contexto electoral, que ustedes ya han oído hablar de eso.
¿En el 2017?
Ajá.
¿En el 2017?
Sí, porque ya estaba en la pre-campaña.
Perdón, dale, sigue.
En 2018 se vivió distinto la huelga internacional, pero estuvo menos convocada, obviamente, ¿no? La gente estaba metida en eso, pero lo que ocurrió es que en diciembre de 2007 hubo un llamado del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional para la realización de un encuentro de mujeres.
So, this year, 2018, the International Women's Strike did not have such a big resonance because in Mexico we've been engulfed in an election year. So there was, you know, there was a different numbers that were brought out. However, this occurred, something else occurred, which is that in 2017, the Zapatistas, in December 2017, the Zapatistas called out In December of 2017, the Zapatistas called out for a meeting of women in 2018, in the spring.
Okay. Y este encuentro es un encuentro que fue un llamado a las mujeres que luchan, resisten y se rebelan contra el sistema capitalista, machista y patriarcal, que fue algo absolutamente sorprendente, ¿no? Que tiene que ver con también los giros y los nuevos del propio ejército zapatista, pero sobre todo está relacionado con el impacto que tuvo la candidatura de María de Jesús Patricio Martínez en las zapatistas.
Okay, so this summit was very important, right? It called on many women to resist and rebel against capitalista, machista violence. And what it also speaks to, this summit convoked by the Zapatistas, are the own turns going on within the Zapatistas, right? And these turns were brought about by the independent campaign of María de Jesús Patricio, known as Marichuy, an indigenous woman who ran as an independent for the elections.
Ella fue la primera mujer candidata, primera mujer indígena que ha sido propuesta como una candidata independiente a la presidencia, que es otro hecho histórico, ¿no? Que nosotros hemos enfrentado.
And so the campaign of Marichuy is remarkable because she was the first indigenous woman to be proposed as a candidate, right? And that is also a historic fact of her campaign.
Lo que fue muy sorprendente fue que la convocatoria tuvo mucho impacto y acudieron entre 7,000 y 9,000 mujeres a la zona de Chiapas, al Caracol Zapatista. Y lo que también es muy sorprendente es los propios balances que pudimos escuchar después de que terminó el encuentro, tanto de las mujeres que asistieron, de vivir esta experiencia de autonomía, porque es un espacio de autonomía, que esto marca una diferencia o por lo menos un cambio en lo que era la forma en como el ejército zapatista conocíamos y trabajaba el feminismo, ¿no? No teníamos.
What comes out of this remark? Hold on. ¿Dónde está el título del? ¿Dónde está el título del?
Del encuentro.
Del encuentro.
Ah, ¿quieres el título? Mm-hmm. ¿O es el primer encuentro internacional?
Gotcha. Okay. So the summit that Zapatistas called is known as the first summit, first international summit. It's a political, artistic, sportive, and cultural summer for women who struggle. And this summit was historic. The call was very surprising. It brought out between 7,000 to 9,000 women for a summit in Chiapas. And the assessments that have come out of it are really interesting. They're very much heralded by women because comrades came out saying that this was a very interesting autonomous experience. It was a women's only summit, and it is very different from other gender politics that the Zapatistas have worked with before.
Eso fue una sorpresa porque el propio ejército zapatista, cuando hacen el balance público, estaban destacando y estaban sorprendidos del impacto que había tenido Marichuy y cómo platicaron. Es muy largo, pero es muy interesante cómo las mujeres en su proceso de organización deciden que sea un encuentro solo de mujeres, y la comandancia tiene que respetarlo porque las otras mujeres comandantes estaban de acuerdo. Duraron como 8 meses preparando, fueron más de 2,000 indígenas de todas las comunidades porque todo lo metieron a discusión.
And so what was, you know, surprising from what comes out as a highlight of this movement, right, is that the Zapatista army highlights in its assessment that the Marichuy campaign organized women in a different way, and that as the summit was being organized, the women from the Zapatista army decided to make it a women's only summit, and that the Zapatista army had to respect this decision. And you know, this mobilized 2,000 indigenous women to pull off this big summit.
Termino con la siguiente frase, porque disculpen, es muy largo por la traducción, pero lo único que quiero decir es de que estamos viviendo muchos cambios, y esto reconfigura el movimiento y abre una ventana de para la construcción de un movimiento claramente de corte anticapitalista que no teníamos, ¿no?
And so just to close on this, right, that this summit is very important because it reconfigures the way that women have been organized, and what we now have is a window opening in which the new feminist movement is actually an anti-capitalist movement.
Excited to be here with all of these incredible women and all of you. So I am not from Ireland, but I'm going to talk about Ireland because our Irish comrade couldn't be here today. And so May 25th in Ireland, 67% of the people who voted to legalize abortion by... by repealing the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which was voted on in 1983, at the same time as you probably know, most Western European countries and the US were liberalizing abortion law. And the Eighth Amendment, I'm gonna read it to you because I think that it's important to actually know what it says. The Eighth Amendment acknowledges the right to life of the unborn and with due regard to the equal right to life of the mother, guarantees in its laws to respect and as far as is practicable by its laws to defend and vindicate that right. So we talk about this in the US, we call them fetal personhood laws. The right has been trying to pass them in places like Mississippi for quite a long time. It literally gives a fetus the equal right to life as the person it is inside of. And what this meant in practice is that abortion was illegal in Ireland in all cases except when the immediate life of the mother was at risk. And that immediate decision was best illustrated by the case of Savita Halappanavar, who died in 2012 after going to the hospital with a wanted pregnancy that she was miscarrying. And she begged for a termination, and there was still a heartbeat. And so the doctors decided that she could sit there for days, septic, begging for them to terminate her pregnancy. And they told her, this is a Catholic country. And they misjudged whether her life was actually at risk. So Savita Halappanavar's face was on a lot of the posters in Ireland in the last month. So this also meant that it was more than just even these kinds of cases. A friend of mine is an attorney there who represented a woman who was in the hospital getting a checkup, and the doctors decided that they thought she should have a C-section on her pregnancy. They took her to court. They appointed a court-appointed lawyer for her fetus. Yep. And they requested to force her to have a C-section, to be able to call the police to bring her back to the hospital should she abscond from the hospital. This was just a couple years ago, y'all. So the other thing about abortion in Ireland is illegal abortion in Ireland. Okay, what is it that we're bringing here? Is that what in practice has happened is that something like 9 women a day travel to the UK to get a legal, safe abortion in the UK. This has been somewhat of a safety valve on Ireland's case because there are stories like Savita Halappanavar, but there are not as many horror stories of illegal abortions because people are often able to access them just at great expense and risk to their job, risk to all sorts of things because they are technically doing something illegal. So the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment has been going on for many years. It involved campaigns not from just the feminist movement explicitly, but a vibrant trade union campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment, which kind of shocked me because I can't imagine too many American unions sticking their necks out on that issue. Just to say. And as Natalia was saying, The movement forced the parties to change their position. Most of the major parties in Ireland were anti-choice, essentially up until about a year ago. And this came around, so you had the four major parties in the Republic of Ireland. Three of them, Jesus, what is that? That's, anyway, I have too much technology up here. Yeah. You had the three major parties campaigning as their particular position, and one Fianna Fáil, one of the two center-right parties that mostly switches off in government in Ireland, saying that its members could vote their conscience, but that its leadership did endorse the repeal referendum. So you had this path. The referendum was called after a citizens' committee, after a legislative committee, and called by a conservative government. And this is a point I will come back to in a minute. But I wanted to talk just a little bit about the actual campaign, because the political parties might have finally endorsed it, put up some posters with some faces on them, but the campaign was won on the ground, and it was won by people going door to door and having really tough, messy, personal, complicated conversations about abortion in a very Catholic country. So I spent a week in Ireland going around in some of the most conservative parts of the country, including the one region that voted no in the end. And watching these conversations happen, it's interesting because, you know, we're always told that this is divisive, it's hard to talk about. And there were certainly people who screamed at you that you should be ashamed of yourself, chased you off their lawn. But there were also people who talked about it and shared personal stories. There was a story of a mother and daughter who had not talked to each other about this, and in the course of the campaign found out that they had both had abortions and only told each other the first time because they started to talk about it. And so I think that this, along with the role of smaller left parties that were unabashedly pro-choice, like People Before Profit, the role of the trade union campaign, the role of independent left members of parliament, of which there are quite a lot of independent left women in particular, this is what contributed to this win, and it was way more than we thought. I was, you know, everybody leading up to the day was sort of like, we're gonna win, but we're gonna win like real close, and then it's gonna be just hell because the right is gonna try to stop it in parliament, they're gonna drag it out, and they still haven't passed the law that will actually legalize abortion yet. But 67%. There was one exit poll that said 69%, and we were all really hoping that was gonna be the result, but it was not. So a word on two things before I shut up. One is that the conservative party that is in charge in Ireland right now has been moving towards sort of more socially liberal policies for a while. This is an incredibly right-wing, sort of Thatcherite neoliberal party that now realizes that Ireland's status as an international tax haven can be much more appealing if gay marriage is legal, abortion is legal, and the prime minister is a smiling son of immigrants who is gay and wears fancy socks. Leo Varadkar is not your friend. But he is going to no doubt use this to campaign on in the next election, and this presents a challenge that I just sort of want people to, you know, think about as we're going forward, is that these campaigns are incredibly important. They are not divisive to the class struggle, as we've already said. But you do have to figure out on that end who your friends are and how to actually, you know, separate yourself on the end from saying this guy, you know, called this referendum and he's going to call himself the hero of, you know, Irish women, and he's not in many ways. And then the final thing is that abortion is still going to be illegal in Northern Ireland, and they are using the momentum from this to push forward immediately. There is a big rally today in Belfast, there have been two others, and because Northern Ireland is in the unique position of being technically part of the UK, where abortion is legal and paid for by the NHS, and well, dominated by a right-wing nationalist party that Theresa May needs to prop up her government. And so on that note, I will. We can talk about all of those things later.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.